It would be tragic indeed if we were going to meet God and He was going to determine our eternal destiny, and we knew nothing about Him. We did not know what He wanted out of us. We did not know what kind of a being He was, whether He was completely strict in His judgment with no mercy, or whether He was merciful or not. And as Wally prayed in his prayer, what a blessing it is to be able to open the Word of God and learn something about our God and His nature. And this book of Lamentation can help us with that indeed. In fact, at the end of our study, we were in Lamentation chapter 3, and we were talking about some verses beginning in verse 19 through 45. You'll note on your lesson, here we have an exhortation to contemplate the cause of their affliction, and that should turn the heart to seek God's compassion. We had suggested you do some marking there that emphasizes that is what the poet is doing this particular section. You'll note, for example, in verse 19, remember my affliction and my wandering. Notice verse 20, my soul remembers. Verse 28 is an exhortation. Let him sit alone and be silent. Verse 29, let him put his mouth in the dust. Perhaps there is hope. In other words, be quiet and listen and think about this. Note he says, let him give his cheek to the smiter, let him be filled with reproach. And then you come down to verse 40. Let us examine and probe our ways. Now here's where this comes into play so much. One of the markings that we had suggested in this section, in verse 33 through 39, are the phrases that indicates that what God has done to these people is just. He says, verse 33, he does not afflict willingly. It's not that God gets joy out of bringing this misery. Verse 35, he's certainly not out to deprive a man of justice, to defraud a man in his lawsuit. Of these things the Lord does not approve. You may remember when Job was wanting to consult God. These are some of the charges he was making. I wish I could have you in court. I don't think this is fair. And the writer here is saying that's not the case. And you'll note that he says in verse 39, if we'll think about it like you're encouraged to do in this section, why should any living mortal or any man offer complaint in view of his sins? So if we'll think about it and examine and probe our ways, then we'll come to the conclusion that whatever happens is just. And note verse 42, he confesses, we have transgressed and rebelled. So it's a very sad state of affairs that's pictured in these first two or three chapters, and will be in chapter 4 and 5. But think about it, he says, and it can do you good if you'll contemplate why this has happened. Now, in verse 46 through 54, you see these expressions of deep lament for the situation that they're in. Verse 48, my eyes run down with streams of water. Verse 49, my eyes pour down unceasingly. Verse 51, my eyes bring pain to my soul. Verse 54, water flowed over my head. And so he's in deep grief, deep sorrow, because of the circumstances that they're in. But even in the midst of that deep lament and deep sorrow, you have here in beginning in verse 55, what is he doing? He's praying. He's calling out to God. And in the midst of the times when it seems like we're in the deepest valley and the darkest night, if we can still have the faith to call out to God, that's what he does. I called on your name, O Lord, out of the lowest pit. You have heard my voice. Do not hide your ear from my prayer for relief, from my cry for help. It's interesting here. It's interesting also in chapters 4 and 5 that while he admits that what they're suffering is the result, the consequence of the sins of their fathers and their own sins, he still has enough faith in God's loving kindness to call out to him in prayer for mercy. Would to God people would have that kind of faith even in the darkest despair, suffering for either their sins or the sins of others. And so he said, you heard my voice, my cry for help. You drew near when I called on you. Verse 58, O Lord, you have pleaded my soul's cause. Verse 59, O Lord, you've seen my oppression. Note he says, judge my case. And all through the end of that chapter, he talks about his prayer to God and how God has seen what's being done to him, and that he's asking God to be aware of that and to recompense his enemies accordingly. Note verse 64, "You'll recompense them, O Lord, according to the work of their hands." Throughout Jeremiah and Lamentation, we run across what's called imprecatory prayers, where a godly, righteous man prays that God will avenge him of his enemies. You see that here again in this prayer at the end of chapter 3. Okay, let's look at chapter 4. Now, you'll note on the sheet that I gave you, we've got four divisions to chapter 4. And remember that these divisions are arbitrary. Somebody else may divide the chapter up differently. This is just an effort to try to break it up into pieces that we can digest. And so I don't feel like you're bound by this, but it's simply an effort to be able to better understand the flow of thought. So you have the whole concept right there at the top of your page. The once glorious city is ravaged and ruined, and that's what's going to be through the entire chapter. The first 12 verses, you have a reversal of fortunes. He pictures a city who was once glorious, living, as we would say, on top of the world, people that were enjoying that splendor and that honor, and now it's completely upside down. Let's note some of those statements here in the first 12 verses. He starts out in verse 1, "How dark the gold has become, how the pure gold has changed. The sacred stones are poured out at the corner of every street." Not sure that he's talking about the literal gold here because of the next verse. "The precious sons of Zion weighed against the gold." In other words, compared against fine gold. These precious sons who used to be so treasured are now regarded, verse 2, as earthen jars, the work of a potter's hands. No longer are they esteemed. No longer are they honored. One of the markings we suggested that you do in 1 through 12 are the classes of people that have been impacted. So you start out with these precious sons who were honored like gold. They were very valuable. Now they're just treated like common people. They're killed, they're maimed, they're taken captive. There's no regard for them. Complete reversal. The next category of people, if you did the marking, is the infant. You note verse 4, the infant. What's happened to the infant? Well, back up in verse 3, he said, "Even jackals offer the breast and they nurse their young." And certainly any compassionate mother would do that. "But the daughter of my people has become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness. The tongue of the infant cleaves to the roof of its mouth because of thirst. The little ones ask for bread and no one breaks it for them." So here's the infant that used to be able to suckle at his mother's breast and be able to get what he needed for nourishment. To be able to have food to eat, to help him grow, there's nothing. Complete reversal of the status. The infant didn't deserve this. He's suffering the consequences of his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents' sin. Something for us to think about, because the way we're living today filters down to others. And so the infant's fortunes have been changed because of what has happened. Then you have verse 7, "Those who ate delicacies," those who were regarded as either people of aristocrat society or wealth, "are desolate in the streets. Those reared in purple." Purple, of course, was their expensive garments. Now he says, "They embrace ash pits." Look, just look, everything's upside down now. With the destruction of Jerusalem, it's turned over. And why is that? Verse 6, "For the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the sin of Sodom." That's a powerful statement, isn't it? You think nobody could be that bad. And yet, look what he says about them. And so, then you have the consecrated ones, which may be the people of Nazarite vow, maybe others, but be that as it may, at one time they were purer than snow, whiter than milk. Now, verse 8, "Their appearance is blacker than soot. They're not recognized in the streets. Their skin is shriveled on their bones. It is withered. It's become like wood." And so you see, every facet of their society has been impacted. Verse 10, "The compassionate women When you think of compassion being displayed, you think of a mother, don't you? As the maybe the epitome of compassion. She gets up in the night with her kids. She'll give her life for her kids. She'll protect her kids. She gives her own body for her kids. But look what happened. Look at verse 10. Boil their own children. What in the world has happened? God's anger and wrath has been brought upon them for their sin. Note verse 11. The Lord has accomplished His wrath. He has poured out His fierce anger. Why didn't He tell them? He did. Why didn't He give them more than one warning? He gave them thousands of warnings. Prophet after prophet after prophet. But they wouldn't listen. And so, we read back in chapter 1, and when I read this statement, I thought, you know, this is so characteristic of how we think about so many things. So anyway, you're going to hear a sermon on this if the Lord is willing. But anyway, chapter 1, verse 9. Look at it. She did not consider her future, therefore. She's fallen astonishingly. People live in the here and now. They don't think about the consequences down the road. They don't think about the future. And that's the way these people are. We're in the city. We've got wealth. We're honored. Everything's lovely. Look at them now. And so that's the picture that's being presented in the first 12 verses. Now, in verse 13 through 16, you say, well, we know He said it's because of their sins, but what caused them to be engaged in that sin? Well, one of the causes, one of the primary causes is focused on in these verses, verses 13 through 16. And we suggested you mark the corruptness of the prophets and priests there in your marking. And if you did that in verse 13, you'll note, because of the sins of the prophets and the iniquity of her priest. And this is so backwards. It's not because of the gangs, you know. It's not because of the radical people out in the street. No, it's the people who ought to be leading the way. It's the people who ought to be teaching. It's the people who ought to be examples. That's the ones. The prophets and the priest. And so, they've shed in their midst the blood of the righteous. And then He describes their wretched condition now in verse 14 on. And verse 16, He said, the Lord has scattered them. He'll not continue to regard them. And they, if the they refers to men among the nations at the end of verse 15, they did not honor the priests. They did not favor the elders. Nor they didn't treat it with any regard either when they were scattered, when they went into other lands. It made a difference. You're an elder or priest. Doesn't mean anything to me. You're a captive or you're a runaway, whatever that may be. So here they were telling the people, peace, peace, peace. Jeremiah's preaching, you're going to be judged. There's judgment coming. There's an army going to conquer you. You need to repent. Prophet's saying, he's not true. Lock him up. Now look at the prophets. And so the people liked what the prophets and priests said. We read about that in Jeremiah because it comforted them and justified them in their lifestyle. But here's what's happened. But what a lesson this is. And I have this right at the end of your lesson. The second bullet point down there at the end of your lesson. Those who lead men into sin will be judged. But those who allow themselves to be led by these will suffer for following them. You remember a statement the Lord made along that very line? That's right. If the blind leads the blind, both will fall into a pit or a ditch. Both. You say, well, it's their fault. It might be their fault. But your job to be discerning. And so, yes, the prophets and priests were wrong. But that did not exempt the people from their responsibility. And now they're suffering for following these fellows. Unfortunately, that's the state of our religious world today. People put their confidence in their preachers and their scholars and their priests and feel good about it. And that's why the world's walking in darkness. And unfortunately, they're going to suffer the consequence of following these men who promise peace when there is no peace. Then in verse 17 following, you have a picture, and we have it there on the top of your lesson. No help and no hope. Their end had come. Even their king was captured. So let's look at that. We suggested you mark those phrases in verse 17 through 20. And if you did, there's quite a few of those kind of phrases here. It's a very sad picture that's being presented. Yet our eyes fail, looking for help was useless. They were looking, looking, looking until their eyes failed. There was no help. In our watching, we have watched. There was intense watching for a nation, but a nation that could not save. Where's Egypt? Where's their helpers? Jeremiah warned them about that, didn't he? Don't go to Egypt. Don't look to Egypt for help. What'd you say, Ennis?
They were watching with expectation.
That's right. They shouldn't have been. You're right. But, you know, looking, there's got to be somewhere here to get us out of this dilemma. No, the only way out is repenting and obeying God, not looking for somebody else to bail you out. But there's no help. And since there's no help, there's no hope. He said, they hunted our steps so we could not walk in the streets. I mean, they're pursuing them everywhere they are. There's no place they can hide. He said, our end drew near. Our days were finished, for our end had come. Is this talking about the end of time?
Their end.
Sir?
Their end.
Okay, and their end, that is, of the Jewish nation. The end of the Jewish nation, as it was once known. Now, remember in 586-7, the last king was destroyed, Zedekiah. Did they ever have another king reigning in Jerusalem, prospering? Never. Never. And never will. I want to point that out because of their prophetic statements about the end. Like in Daniel, that people say, end of time, when it may not be the end of time at all. Maybe the end of these chosen people and their status before God. So just remember that little phrase so that when you're studying in other places, you remember this passage. And so they looked for help, but there was none. Our pursuers were swifter than the eagles of the sky. They chased us on the mountains. They waited in ambush for us in the wilderness. So you can't walk in the streets. We'll escape the city. We'll run off in the mountains. They're going to find you there too. There is no escape. There's no hope. This is a powerful army, trained soldiers. You're going down. That's all there is to it. And he said, the breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, the one that would be the pinnacle of their hope, the one that should protect them, the one that should lead the army in battle, if not literally by command and example, the one that they put their trust in. You know, the kingdoms were never more strong or powerful than the king. And so here's the king, top of the pinnacle, got him to. Remember, Zedekiah tried to get away. Jeremiah said, you're not going to get away. He tried to flee by night through the wall. They got him, blinded him, took him to Babylon. Even our king has been captured. You know, you think about, I'm not a political person very much, but I remember back, was it 1963, I think? My wife and I hadn't been married long. We were walking in a store somewhere and we heard the news about President Kennedy being shot. Now, I wasn't a Kennedy fan. But still, that impacts you. That's our president. That's the leader of our nation. How much more so in a monarchy where the king has been captured? That's what's happened. Now where do we turn? Who's going to guide our nation? There is no one. And so, no hope. So, you can see that they were hoping to live under the shadow of the king's wing and his protection there in verse 20. So, we had suggested you mark in 21 and 22 the geographical indicators, and you have a kind of a change here, a switch in 21 and 22. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. Remember, Edom rejoiced at Jerusalem's fall. They were glad to see him fall. When the people were fleeing from Jerusalem, they rejoiced. But he said, the cup will come around to you as well. You'll become drunk and make yourself naked. In a chapter in Jeremiah, we saw that imagery used where Jeremiah is passing the cup around, as it were, to the nations. They say, I'm not drinking that. Yeah, you're going to drink it. It's the cup of God's wrath. You're going to drink it. And so you're rejoicing that God's wrath, that giant had to drink the cup. But it's coming around to you. It's coming. And you'll note at the end of the chapter, of chapter 4, he'll punish your iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He'll expose your sins. So I put on the last bullet point on this sheet. You can see right at the bottom. God's rule and law extends to all parts of the earth and to all races of men. It is true that Zion was his special people. But if Edom had sins, what does that imply? What must you have to be guilty of sin? You must have law. They were under law to the God of Israel. Isn't that interesting? Or there'd be no such thing as sin. So it doesn't make any difference if people live in Africa, South America, if they don't believe in God, it doesn't make any difference. They're under law to the great Creator and will be held accountable for their sins. Men are not going to be lost because they didn't hear the gospel. There are babies who've never heard the gospel who will not be lost. Men are going to be lost because they're in sin. The gospel is the means of redemption. So, universal authority God has over all nations. Now, but then he says about Zion, the punishment of your iniquity has been completed, O daughter of Zion. He will exile you no longer. It's very interesting. We don't have time to deal with it, but just something you might want to note. Go compare this verse in other versions. The way this one is translated, it sounds like their exile will come to an end. That may be what he's saying. Some versions, like the King James and the American Standard, say, will no more carry you away, as if it's talking about the future. You'll never be captives again. And if that's correct, this may be a messianic passage. I don't know for sure. But it's interesting to compare the versions there on that particular verse. Okay. I'll get it here on chapter 5. I've got another note here, but I'll pick it up on chapter 5. So let's look at chapter 5. I didn't put it on your lesson, but chapter 5, you can divide it into two parts. The first 18 verses, and then verse 19 through 22. The first 18 verses is a plea. The whole chapter is a prayer. Their prayer to God. And we have that at the very top of your page. They're languishing in misery, and they're pleading with God to be restored to his favor. Well, that first 18 verses is a plea for God. Look at verse 1 to remember. Does God forget? No, God doesn't forget. When the word remember is used in the Bible, remember the Sabbath day, what follows that? To keep it holy. You remember with consequent action. That's the idea. And so, if the Lord tells us, for example, to remember his death in the Lord's Supper, Oh, yeah, I remember he died. No, there's consequent action. That ought to impact how I live, living under the covenant ratified by his blood. Remember Lot's wife. Oh, yeah, that was a nice story. Is that it? No. And when they ask God to remember, they're asking God to act. Look at our state. Look at what we're suffering. Do something. Help us, please. That's the idea. But first, it's a focus in these first 18 verses on this very thing they're asking God to be aware of. You may think God has forgotten you. God doesn't. God doesn't forget you. And you may think, well, God doesn't know how bad I feel and what's been happening. Yes, he knows. Yes, he does. You might ask him to help relieve the situation. And that's what they're going to ask. So, remember, O Lord, now one of the things we suggested that you note there in our second marking, you note I have that little phrase that's in verse 2. What has befallen us? Then again in the next line, our reproach. Look and see what? Our reproach. That's what they're praying about. That he's going to detail in verse 2 through 16. You could mark all that in one color if you wanted to, but I put mine in two different colors. But anyway, it's not important. But anyway, when you get to verse 17, you have that again. Look at verse 17. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of what? All these things he talked about, verse 2 through 16. Because of this. So, Lord, look what's befallen us. Our reproach. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes are dim. That's why we're just beaten down and disheartened and in such bad, bad shape. Well, in these intervening verses, he began to talk about the very things that had befallen them. And this is one of those sections where, as I put on the sheet, if you were to mark everything that he said, you'd have just a solid marking from verse 2 on down. So you have to kind of be selective and pick some words that 6 months from now, if you go back and look at Lamentations, you see those highlighted words and you say, oh yeah, I remember that, and it catches your attention. So again, this marking is an art, not a science, and everybody's going to do it different. You might not even like to do it. That's okay. But it's just a suggestion to be able to get a bird's eye view, a larger focus of what's going on in a section. So let's look, starting in verse 2. Our inheritance. What's one of the most... major in factors of an inheritance when somebody dies?
Money.
Well, money's one.
Land
and houses, right? Especially if they've been wealthy and doing well. Look at the next line. See, I didn't mark houses because inheritance captures it. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers. Our houses to aliens. If you're the parents or grandparents, we have nothing to leave our children. If you're the children, we have nothing to inherit. It's all gone. Is that important to people? Oh, yes. Parents die, man, even brothers and sisters get in a dogfight over the inheritance. Who's going to get the house or the money from the house, that kind of thing. There's no fight here. They got it. You don't have it. And so something maybe the parents worked for all their lives, maybe got from their parents. It's all gone. We've become orphans without a father. I don't know if he's talking about the fact that many of the men had been killed in war or not. That's possible. There's people in this audience that grew up without a father, lost in their lives. There's a lot of them here that would grow up that way, boys and girls, without a father and the father's influence. And our mothers are like widows. Widows, women who've lost their husbands, they're by themselves, young and old, different stages of life. And remember, they're not living in a time where there's Medicare and Medicaid and all of that. How are you going to live if your husband's gone, your daddy's gone? What are you going to do? We've reverted to captivity, haven't we? We pay for drinking water. They thought that was a curse. Of course, we don't have to pay for drinking water. They had to pay to get water to drink. Imagine that. We pay. And I just guess it wasn't like you pay 10 cents a bottle for a cup of good water. It's whatever their oppressor decided to charge them. We pay for drinking water. What about wood? Wood to fuel our stoves. Wood to fuel our fireplaces. Wood for whatever we use it. You got to buy that too. You can't just go out to the forest and get it. No, you're a captive. Wood at a price. Verse 5, our pursuers are at our necks. You ever hear people say, get off my neck. Get off my back. What's the idea? You're pressing me all the time. That's the idea. Look, they said, we're worn out. There's no rest for us. Remember in Egypt? Not only did Pharaoh make it hard, but once Moses went to Pharaoh and said, I'm going to make it harder. These monarchs had no regard for human life. And here they are now at their mercy. He said, we've got to go to Egypt and Syria to get enough bread. So they can't just go out in the field and get their harvest and make bread. Got to get it from somewhere else. Verse 7, he says, our fathers sinned. That's true. And they're suffering for that. But look down at verse 16. He's not trying to escape guilt. Verse 16, he said, woe to us, for we have sinned. And it may well be that sometimes people suffer in their lives for both reasons. Their fathers sinned, and they suffer for that. And they followed in their father's steps, and they suffer for that. That was the case here, at least. One thing we can do is to try to so live that our children never have to say, we're suffering because our fathers and mothers sinned. To do everything in our power not to leave them with that kind of legacy. Slave rule over us, verse 8. Bad enough to be under dominion of somebody, but slave rule over us. And there's no one to deliver us. Verse 9, we get bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. You're going to go out in the wilderness and try to get something to make bread? They might kill you. Because of verse 10, our skin has become hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine. Can't eat, skin gets hot, your body changes. They ravish the women in Zion. Some versions translate this, they raped the women in Zion. Not sure what all is implied in that word, but I wouldn't be surprised. That's the idea. Carried them off, used them, abused them. And note the virgins in the cities of Judah. Women who had never known a man, didn't make them any difference. This is what happens in war. I had a brother who served in World War II. In fact, met his wife. She was a Polish woman. And one occasion she told me about this very thing happening when the armies would come in. Very thing that you're reading about here back in the 40s, 1940s. And here you read about it here. Then you read about, verse 12, princes were hung by their heads, elders were not respected. Don't make a difference who you are, what position you have, hanging. Verse 13, what about the young men? It says they worked at the grinding mill, but that's not like, hey, I got a good job here, make $20 an hour. No, look, They stumbled underneath the loads of wood. I mean, they're put to the test. Burdens, heavy burdens. Elders are going from the gate. Used to, you can go to the gate, get judgment for what's going wrong. No elders at the gate. Young men from their music. There's no young men to play music. The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. And so, that's why, Lord, verse 17, we're praying for you to remember us. Verse 18, because of Mount Zion was lying desolate, foxes prowl in it. Now, you know, we put at the end of your lesson here, This is a tragic state, and yet these people still have faith, some degree of faith anyway, in the loving kindness and mercy of God. Because you see, verse 19, you, O Lord, rule forever. And so they know God's the ruler. They're not denying that. They're not challenging that. And it's not just the rule to punish, though. Look, verse 20. Why do you forget us forever? You have the power. You rule. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? What do you want? Here's what we want. Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. I don't care how deep the valley, how dark the night, how ruined the life, how sorry the history. You can be like the prodigal son. Waste everything you had, living a profligate life, eating with the pigs. But if you come home, God will be waiting. Isn't that great? Romans 15:4, I have it on your lesson. Paul said, whatever was written aforetime, in earlier time, written for our instruction, so that we through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures might have hope. There ought to be hope in this. And if you ever have to work with somebody who's so distraught because of the mess sin has got them in, remember these passages. But there's another side to this story. Look at the last verse. Unless you've utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. Go over to Luke chapter 16. You remember how we read about the reversal of the city in chapter 4? How things just flip-flopped? That's the status here. Here's a rich man. Fine clothes, plenty of food, nice house. He dies. Tables are turned upside down. Everything changes now. And so in Hades, verse 23, he lifted up his eyes, being in torment. And saw Abraham far away and Lazarus in his bosom. Now, just like these people were being tormented and they cried out, restore us. This rich man cried out, said, Father Abraham, have mercy. Have mercy on me. But Abraham said, verse 25, you remember? Memory is a faculty God gave us for good, but it can also be a terrible punishment. Do you remember all those times in your life and Lazarus was there begging, and you were living good, and you didn't care, and the way you lived. But verse 26, besides all this, between us and you, there's a great chasm fixed, so that those who wish to come over from here to you will not be able, and that none may cross over from there to us. In other words, in the words of Lamentation chapter 5, verse 22, sorry, you've been utterly rejected. Too late to pray. There's no mercy now. There's no hope at all. In Matthew 13, look at Matthew 13:41. The Son of Man will send forth His angels, and they'll gather out of His kingdom all stumbling blocks and those who commit lawlessness, and throw them into the furnace of fire. In that place there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. A furnace of fire, weeping and gnashing of teeth. Maybe pain, maybe regret for missed opportunities. Look at verse 49 and 50. So it'll be at the end of time, the angels will come forth and take out the wicked from among the righteous and throw them into the furnace of fire. In that place there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. In chapter 22 and verse 13, the king said to his servants, bind him hand and foot, throw him into the outer darkness. So over there was the furnace of fire. Here's the outer darkness. No light, no peace, no joy in that place. There'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, we read Romans a while ago. Let's finish our study by looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. This applies to everything we've studied from the time we opened Jeremiah on the first class. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. Paul went back and talked about several historical incidents that are recorded in the Old Testament and the judgments that God brought upon them. That's what we've been reading about in Jeremiah and Lamentation. Not the ones Paul mentioned, but others like that. And he said in verse 11, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the end of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. And that's a good lesson to quit Jeremiah and Lamentations on. I want to thank you for your kind words of encouragement. Several of you commented about the class. You've enjoyed it, and I appreciate that. We're through with this particular study. If you haven't picked up Doug's lessons, we encourage you to do that. Lord willing, he's scheduled to start Sunday on a very important study on the church. He's done a lot of work. He's got material ready. We encourage you to cooperate with him. Pick up those lessons. Thank you for your attention.